So as Johnny just said, my name is Eilis, and I have the privilege of speaking or preaching today from Acts 25. So we've reached chapter 25 in the never-ending story of Acts. It will come to an end one day, like all things on this earthly plane, but it has not yet come to an end. So we are still there. So can I just encourage you, can you be turning to Acts 25 now? In readiness. We're going to be reading it in a few moments together. What I felt God lay on my heart as I read this passage is the difference between the worldly leadership that we see in this passage and the godly leadership that we see demonstrated in this passage. So I'm going to be talking today on the difference between worldly leadership and godly leadership, and how whatever areas of life that we have leadership within, we want to be leading in a godly way, don't we? So we're going to be thinking about that this morning. So let's just look at the story so far. So we have met Paul, and as Johnny talked about last week, he was put in kind of a house arrest type situation by Felix, and he left him there for over 2 years. He kept hoping that he'd pay him a bribe or there'd be some sort of way that he could get out of prison. And basically he did that to keep the political peace. Okay, he didn't want to stir up trouble, and so he left Paul where he was for 2 years. In that time, Paul keeps just faithfully doing what he can do from that situation. You know, he was allowed people to come and help look after him, but every time he met with Felix, he was sharing the gospel. He was just doing what he could do and blessing the people that were imprisoning him, even within his limited situation. But then we see now at the start of chapter 25, Felix is moved on for various reasons, and a new leader is installed. And this leader is called Festus, Porcius or Porcius Festus, which is a great name, isn't it? I just picture him a certain way because of that name, but there we go. So this new leader comes in, and it's only 3 days. Now, he's quite keen to get started. You know, when you come into something new, you want to really make your impact, don't you? You want to be noticed. So he's kind of looking at all the cases and stuff. But it's only 3 days after he comes into this new powerful position that the Jewish leaders or Jewish authorities approach him about Paul. 2 years later, and they give it 3 days, and they're there. They have not forgotten. They have not let this go. Felix thought, oh, I'll just leave him there. Let it all settle down. Maybe it will just go away. Hadn't gone away. They've really kept going with this. They are really determined to get to Paul. They had come up with three areas under the law that they were trying to get him charged with. So they wanted him charged either with sedition, so they were saying that he was stirring up riots amongst the Jews across the empire. Now, Roman law forbade the stirring up of or causing of public unrest. So we're like, right, that's number one. We'll try and get him on that one. Secondly, Judaism was protected under the Romans. They were allowed to worship. Traditional Judaism and their practices could go on under Roman law. But new religions, well, they were not permitted in the same way. So they were then trying to accuse Paul of starting up a new sect and being the ringleader of this new sect, which they called the Nazarenes, which would then mean he wasn't protected as a Jew. They were trying to sort of say Christianity is different from Judaism, therefore he's not protected, therefore he's starting up this new religion, therefore we can get him on that. Just in case those two weren't enough, they then also accused him of bringing Greeks into the temple. Under Jewish law, that would have been a capital offence. And under Roman law, they allowed the Jews to have authority over that and to carry out that capital offence. Okay, so we're in an occupied territory. So the Jews have certain powers and certain limits, and then the Romans permit them to have those, but they have the ultimate authority over those. So that's the kind of situation we find ourselves in. And this is what Paul is coming up against. So Festus has come in as a new leader. He doesn't really understand Judaism. He doesn't really understand the politics of the area. He's just been drafted in and dumped into this place. And so the Jewish authorities come straight up with these three arguments. And they're hoping that now with this new leader, you know, they can get him, basically, they can get Paul. So let's now read chapter 25 with that in mind and just see what happens next. Okay, so bear with. Okay. Hopefully you've got chapter 25. Good. No one's rustling, so I'll take that as a good sign. 3 days after arriving in the province, Festus went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem, where the chief priests and the Jewish leaders appeared before him and presented the charges against Paul. They requested Festus as a favour to them to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem, for they were preparing an ambush to kill him along the way. Festus answered, "Paul is being held at Caesarea, and I myself am going there soon. Let some of your leaders come with me, and if the man has done anything wrong, they can press charges against him there." After spending 8 or 10 days with them, Festus went down to Caesarea. The next day he convened the court and ordered that Paul be brought before him. When Paul came in, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood round him. They brought many serious charges against him, but they couldn't prove them. Then Paul made his defence. "I've done nothing wrong against the Jewish law or against the temple or against Caesar." Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favour, said to Paul, "Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me there on these charges?" Paul answered, "I am now standing before Caesar's court, where I ought to be tried. I've not done any wrong to the Jews, as you yourself know very well. If, however, I am guilty of doing anything deserving death, I don't refuse to die. But if the charges brought against me by these Jews are not true, no one has the right to hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar." After Festus had conferred with his council, he declared, "You have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you will go." A few days later, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea to pay their respects to Festus. Since they were spending many days there, Festus discussed Paul's case with the king. He said, "There is a man here whom Felix left as a prisoner. When I went to Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews brought charges against him and asked that he be condemned. I told them that it is not the Roman custom to hand over anyone before they have faced their accusers and have had an opportunity to defend themselves against the charges. When they came here with me, I did not delay the case, but convened the court the next day and ordered the man to be brought in. When his accusers got up to speak, they didn't charge him with any of the crimes I'd expected. Instead, they had some points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a dead man named Jesus, whom Paul claimed was alive. I was at a loss how to investigate such matters, so I asked if he would be willing to go on to Jerusalem and stand trial there on these charges. But when Paul made his appeal to be held over for the emperor's decision, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar." Then Agrippa said to Festus, "I would like to hear this man myself." He replied, "Tomorrow you will hear him." The next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp and entered the audience room with the high-ranking military officers and the prominent men of the city. At the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. Festus said, "King Agrippa and all who are present with us, you see this man. The whole Jewish community has petitioned me about him in Jerusalem and here in Caesarea, shouting that he ought not to live any longer. I found he had done nothing deserving of death, but because he made his appeal to the emperor, I decided to send him to Rome. But I have nothing definite to write to His Majesty about him. Therefore, I have brought him before all of you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that as a result of this investigation, I may have something to write. For I think it's unreasonable to send a prisoner on to Rome without specifying the charges against him." Okay. So, in the first place, we see Paul before Festus. Paul had revealed that he was a Roman citizen. And Roman citizenship was very rare and very coveted. Only about 5 to 10% of the entire population of the Roman world had got this citizenship. And it gave you 3 shields within their justice system. The first one was exemption from degrading punishment. Okay, so you couldn't be tortured, you couldn't be flogged, you couldn't be scourged. Okay, and you were exempt usually from crucifixion. Now, the previous governor and the guards were already in a sticky situation with Paul because he'd revealed this and they'd not treated him particularly nicely up to this point. So they were on a little bit of a sticky wicket at that point anyway. The second shield that it gave you was the right to a formal trial. Okay, so what it meant was that public pressure couldn't lead to you being imprisoned or crucified or executed or anything like that. There had to be a proper legal process before you are punished. And that's why Paul talks when he comes before Festus, I am before you now. I am presenting my case before you now. This is the proper legal process. You can't, just because this crowd want me executed or imprisoned, that's not the proper legal process. I'm a Roman citizen. You need to follow this process. I don't need to go to Jerusalem because I'm being heard here now. But he can see Festus is wavering. He can see Festus is going to be under this political pressure. He's new to this role, doesn't quite get it, needs to keep the peace, needs to have a success under his belt as he's starting his role. So Paul, I believe, at this point, weighs up the pros and the cons, and that's at the point he says, I appeal to Caesar. Because at that point, he invokes the third shield of being a Roman citizen, which is, if you appeal to Caesar, every Roman citizen had the right, when they were being heard, to appeal to Caesar, and at that point, local law ceased to exist for them. They had to be sent directly to Caesar to be heard by him, and only he would then decide their fate. So that was to avoid the very situation that Paul was in, where political influence or bribery or whatever could lead to an unfair trial. So Paul weighs up the situation that he's in locally, the fact he's been held for 2 years, the fact this new governor doesn't seem to, you know, be swaying, and so he appeals to Caesar. Now that's great at one point, but then we see the second part, which is where Paul is heard by King Agrippa. Now, within Roman law, again, in a trial situation, you were allowed to bring in an expert consultant as the person making the decision. So the governor here realizes he doesn't have the knowledge about the Jewish law, the Jewish customs, the province, the area. So he brings in King Agrippa to act as his expert consultant. King Agrippa was raised in Imperial Rome and in that court, so he was an expert on Roman law, but he also served as the curator of the temple in Jerusalem, so he was well versed in all the customs and the controversies of the Jews. So by bringing Agrippa in, Paul felt that that would be a, you know, he'd have the knowledge. Agrippa agrees that Paul is actually innocent of all these charges. And so if Paul hadn't appealed to Caesar, in theory, he could have been let go at that point. Okay, but Paul has appealed to Caesar, so now none of their opinions matter anymore. He has to now legally be sent to Caesar in Rome. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. Paul did what he felt was right, but he also has this prophetic word, doesn't he, from earlier in Acts that says when he goes to Jerusalem, he'll be bound and led where you do not want to go, that kind of thing. So he's kind of really having to use his wisdom, but there's also a submission to God in going to Jerusalem, despite what some of his friends and advisors would have told him, begging, pleading with him not to go. He feels that is right within the spirit and within what God's called him to do. And so he's kind of submitting to God's will within that moment as well. So that leaves Festus with a slight issue because now Paul has appealed to Caesar. Festus has to send a written brief to the emperor outlining the charges against him. Again, Festus then uses Agrippa in this because the charges seem to be purely religious, so Festus needed the proper legal vocabulary to be able to present this and frame them as Roman crimes. And so apparently Agrippa does that, and so Paul is going to be on his way to Rome. I think I said Jerusalem, didn't I? But I meant Rome. Okay. So I want to look at, from this, how Paul is demonstrating godly leadership here by trusting in God. And we're going to just take a few moments. We're going to go a little bit deep with our theology here. Not too deep because I'm not an expert, okay? But just touch on an area of who is this God that Paul is trusting in, putting his life in the hands of. Because from Paul's perspective, and from our perspective as Christians, it's God who's supposed to be in charge. It's not the Roman Empire. It's not whatever justice system you happen to be having to submit to. It's overall, it's God in charge. And God reveals within the Bible three things, well, more than three things, but there are three things we're going to look at now that he reveals about himself. The word omnipotent means all-powerful. So in the Bible, God is revealed, and he reveals himself as all powerful. I'm now going to try and find. Ah, yay. Isaiah 40, verse 27 says, "Why do you complain, Jacob? Why do you say, Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord? My cause is disregarded by my God. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom." God reveals himself as all-powerful, and when we get even a tiny glimpse of that God, as Paul did, then that calls for our attitude to be one of utter confidence. Now, we live in a broken world, and trusting in God with that kind of confidence is hard because there are often impossibilities. Paul knows that to go to Rome probably means suffering, potentially death. But he's trusting in a God that is all-powerful. Our personal circumstances, we can seem so difficult, but actually God, if we believe in him and he declares himself to be omnipotent, all-powerful, he is over that. He doesn't grow tired. He doesn't grow weary. He is over it all. Another thing that God reveals about himself is that he is omnipresent. He is everywhere present. In Psalm 139, a really well-known psalm. Sorry, I'm just flicking about a bit. So Psalm 139. I brought my tiny Bible, which seemed a good idea at the time, but it's actually quite hard to turn the pages. Psalm 139. So I'm going to read verses 7 onwards for a bit. "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you." In the Bible, we find a God revealed who is present everywhere at all times. We can't escape his presence. That can be really disturbing. Actually, if we're in a place where we're not living right before God, that can really disturb us. There's nowhere we can go. We cannot escape this God. However far we try and run, he's there. However dark we go, he's there. But it's also such a reassurance, isn't it? No matter how far we run, no matter how dark we go, we cannot escape his presence. He is there. So if you are in a particularly dark or distant place this morning, God is there. When evil appears to go unchallenged, God knows and sees it all. If there are things in your life that you've experienced that are awful, it's a mystery, but God was there. And the next point, we'll go on to look at that because that raises some questions, doesn't it? It also reveals in the Bible that he is omnipresent in time. There is no moment that was before God. There will be no moment that is after God. He is always. And finally, for this morning, the Bible reveals that God is omniscient. He is all-knowing. Verse 1 of the same psalm says, "You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain." This is, again, disturbing and reassuring. If you began to ask the question, well, if God was there when I suffered that, why didn't he do something about it? One day he will. Johnny touched on Judgment Day, and we don't talk about it very often because it's disturbing, because it doesn't really go along with our nice, comfortable, hedonistic way of life. But the truth is, all time is now to God. There isn't a past to him. There isn't a future. It is now. When judgment day comes, every judgment that God makes will be utterly just, because he knows every thought, every motive of every person that has ever existed. He was there in every moment that everything occurred. He saw every person's history, and he sees it right then as if it's happening right at that moment. We trust in human judges and human juries, but God's judgment will be utterly just. The Bible shows us that with God there are mysteries, but never mistakes. God doesn't know in part, he knows in whole. And so he offers complete truth, complete justice. And the Bible shows us that actually Jesus is the ultimate revelation of God. And in him is all the treasure of wisdom and knowledge. It might be today that there are some things that are hidden and that's made you feel really bad. I'm not here to make you feel really bad, okay? God doesn't come and condemn. What he does is there might be areas where he just puts a fingerprint on something and says, I want to come with my spirit and I want to work with you to change that. Will you let me do that? Okay? None of us are perfect. There is no one that can stand before the judgment seat of God apart from what Jesus has done. We're all human. We all make mistakes. Okay? But also, if you've had terrible things done to you, there will be a day when that is put right. Whatever happens in this lifetime. And we can trust, or as Christians, we believe we can trust God with that. Okay, so, how is it supposed to work then? There's God, who is all-knowing. He is supposed to be in charge. When he created mankind, he gave us a role under him. So we were supposed to submit to God's authority, and we were supposed to rule and order creation, and enjoy it all, but under his authority. But we messed that up and gave away our authority. And that had consequences, and those consequences are still going on today. When we gave away our authority, we broke relationship with God. We said, we don't trust you. We don't want to do things your way. We believe you're lying to us. We believe you're hiding things from us. We believe we'd be better making it on our own. So that made us unfit to be in God's presence anymore. It made us unable to fulfill God's will anymore. We were now not right before God and before his law. We couldn't live according to his law anymore. We broke it and we became insensitive to God's word. So we had the dream, now we have the reality. Because of this broken relationship with God, because mankind wants dominion over the world on its own terms, we claim mastery of the world and we assume responsibility for the destiny of our own race. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? But unfortunately, we can't escape the fact that God is real and that there are consequences to us not coming under his authority, because this universe and this creation is made to be subject to his authority. We have an inevitable sense within us that things aren't quite how they should be. We want justice. We want peace. We want security. But all we seem to get is conflict, exploitation, fear, and misunderstanding between us as human beings. We feel we have value as human beings. And so, you know, we try and find our value. We try and make our value out of all sorts of things, but they're distorted because our value should be coming from God. And it's not. We're trying to seek it in all these other things. So we become susceptible to deceiving ourselves. We become susceptible to shame. And we become restless. There's this constant kind of shuffle within ourselves. We see creation. We go on walks. We pay some money to go and see beautiful places in the world. We kind of have this sense that creation is beautiful and precious and we should be looking after it. And yet at the same time, we're exploiting it. We're polluting it. We're using up the world's resources. We have this feeling that death is wrong, that people shouldn't die, that we shouldn't die. And so we live our days, counting our days, knowing that inevitably we're going to die. So time is just this thing that is against us, this ticking clock. We have our bucket lists. We have our anxiety. We have our hedonism. We have our materialism to try and make the most of what we've got because we know it's going to come to an end. And that feels wrong. Fortunately, God didn't leave us in that place. Jesus came, God as man, and he lived the life that humanity should have lived in relationship to God. He knew and showed unbroken communion with the Father. He always gave himself away for others. He knew who he was. He had a complete, healthy, whole awareness of himself. He knew who he was in terms to the Father. He knew he was loved. He knew what his Father's will was for his life, and he gave himself for that. He spent his whole life establishing the kingdom of God. He, worked with creation. He sensitively responded to the order of creation that God had put in place, but he equally showed that he had dominion over it. And then finally, as we've been looking at this morning, the final frontier, the inevitable thing that none of us can escape, death, that thing that is held over us, that makes us panic, that gives us this anxiety deep down, that no matter what we do, we cannot escape it. Jesus faced that. He gave himself up to death at 33 years of age, willingly submitted to the Father, the all-knowing God, in what seemed like the biggest mistake of all. But he was triumphant over death. He faced that final hurdle and he overcame it. And now death has lost its sting. When we trust in Jesus, we are reconciled to God. We're back in that position that we should have been in. We're now able to serve others, to live for others, not just to live for ourselves. We're able to have a true awareness of who we are because we now have a true awareness, a true view of ourselves before God. Our identity comes from who God says we are, not from us trying to be something we're not, not from us trying to impress others. We can think of others more than ourselves. We can be truly humble because we have a right view of our strengths and our weaknesses. We don't have to be perfect because only Jesus is perfect. We don't have to be insecure. We can just operate in who we're supposed to be. We don't have to be so preoccupied with ourselves all the time. I fall flat on that all the time. But as we live free in who God's made us to be, we're free to be freed from ourselves, as it were, from constantly thinking about ourselves, free to think about others, free to love others, free to recognize our abilities and spiritual gifts given to us by God, free to use those. That increases our self-respect, doesn't it? Because our self-respect is no longer dependent on what others think of us. It's no longer dependent on what job we have or how many boxes we tick. It's coming from God as it was always designed to be. We become fulfilled because as we dedicate the gifts and abilities that God has made for us and wants for us, then that's defining us, isn't it? And we'll be successful in that because that is who God has made us to be. And so we're going to feel so fulfilled in what he's made us to be and do. And time. This enemy for the whole of humanity is now given to us as a tool by God. We get as long as he gives us, and we get to use it in his service. We get to use the time he gives us as he directs us to. And when our time is over, we know that's not it for us. We have eternity stretching before us because Jesus has defeated the grave. And that's not it now. We haven't just got this time on earth. We've got eternity to come. So we now come back to these leadership models that we see within this passage. We have the worldly leaders. We have Felix and Festus and Agrippa. Power-driven, fearful, compromising, untrustworthy. Proud, they've made it. They're at the top of their game, but how do they stay at the top of their game, or will they make some compromises? They do some things they're not proud of. But they're powerful men. Now, this isn't saying politics is wrong, this isn't saying politics is worldly leadership, but, you know, it's that sense of we know how things work, we know who the power players are in this area, and we work the system to our own good. They knew what they had to do to maintain their position, and that's what led their decisions and their choices. So they were wily and they used others. They were perfectly happy to use Paul as long as they were okay. They rushed through things. Oh, get it done quickly, whatever is easiest. And they would just drive things through regardless of the consequences. Maybe you've experienced leadership like that. Maybe you're under it right now. Maybe you've been a leader like that. It's really easy, isn't it? That's how the world works. That's how you get places. Compromise a little bit here. Oh, I'm a bit scared. I better do that. We've all done it. I'm really not speaking from a place of perfection here, okay? This is how the world works. But when we see, as Christians, that we are free from that now, that we are free to lead as Jesus led, we are free to lead like Paul demonstrated in this passage, what kind of leadership do we see then when God's in control, when we're submitted to his authority as we should be? Well, then we see that we're able to step into God's plans even when they don't seem to make sense to us. Even when God's plan didn't seem to make sense to the other Christians around him, Paul was able to step into God's plans, even when God's plans for Jesus seemed completely incomprehensible and the worst thing ever, he was able to step into those because his confidence was in God, in that all-knowing, all-powerful, all-seeing, all-present God. It enables us to be fearless as leaders, to make decisions not based on what worries us, but on what God is saying to us. It enables us to be bold, to do what needs to be done. It enables us to be focused on others, on what's best for other people, not just securing what's best for ourselves, not just wanting to appear good. It enables us to be sacrificial when it's required, because actually our time, our gifts, our abilities are all from God. We're not the one that has to struggle to fight and strive to keep those. It enables us to be humble and think of others more than ourselves and to have a right view of ourselves, not putting ourselves down, but not overinflating ourselves. Just we are who we are before God. By God's grace, we are who we are. We do what we do faithfully. And we serve others, but we're also wise and discerning. Paul used his wisdom, he used his knowledge of the Roman legal system. He didn't just lie there like a flat pancake and take whatever was given to him. He was wise within that. Jesus made wise decisions all through his life. We're called to be wise and discerning in whatever areas we lead in, but fully submitted to God's will. So I want us to think about where and how are we leading. Maybe we're leading in our home. Maybe we've got children or dependents or others. Maybe we're leading at work. Maybe we lead a team. Maybe we lead a massive area. I don't know. Are you in leadership in work? Maybe you're in leadership in the church. Maybe you lead a life group. Maybe you're involved in a ministry. Maybe you're on the 3-2-1 and you're helping out on that. Maybe you're, you know, putting out tea and coffee. Maybe you're discipling another Christian. That's all forms of leading within the church. But even if you're not leading in any of those areas, and I would argue you probably are, we're called to lead ourselves as Christians as well, aren't we? We're called to take responsibility for our actions and lead ourselves. So I just felt God this morning wants us to think about, are we leading in a worldly way out of fear, out of insecurity, out of seeking what's best for ourselves, or are we leading in a godly way under his authority, submitted to him? And I just felt it would be really good, you know, if you're in leadership in whatever position or whatever place, I just felt it would be really good for us to pray for you. But I don't necessarily want to call everyone out the front, you know, but we can gather around and we can pray for you, that God would just help you, give you strength, give you what you need so that you can lead in a way that brings glory to him. And there's also the other side of that, isn't there, that where if you've been hurt by leadership, maybe in the workplace, maybe in the church, wherever, that actually there can be healing for you and you can know that God's got it. Maybe you're in a particularly difficult situation at work at the moment where you've got a leader that is, you know, putting you under some pressure because of the way they're leading, and we'd love to pray for you. So I think if we could have the band come back up, that would be great. And let's just focus on our wonderful God, on the God that is all-powerful, all-knowing, all-present. And let's just let him speak to us. You know, are there areas that he's highlighting? Are there areas where you've just been leading in your own strength and actually you want to give that back over to him again? Are there areas where damage has been done to you and you just want to let him in to begin to heal some of those areas? Are there areas where you want to step into leadership or you haven't even recognized that you're in leadership? And actually, you just want to say to God, would you help me to lead in a way that brings glory to you in whatever area that comes in? So let's just spend a few moments doing that, I think.